Thank you, Paul. I was going to tell the story about the jacket, but Paul stole my thunder. So I'll just have to get right to the poetry. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight and to see Paul again. And the evening's not over. Maybe I'll find something to steal from. Maybe a line of verse. Who knows? I'm going to read mostly from this book that Paul just told you about. The book is divided into four sections, and it covers, of course, 50 years. The first section is called Early Poems, and I'll read just a bit from this section. The first poem I'll read called The Lion, and this was written when I was in my 30s, and at a time when I still thought that death was a dirty trick. The Lion. It's strange that the lion thinks of me as food. I touch my hand to the contours of my body, renewing acquaintance with them. I am aware that at 34 my flesh is not yet flabby, but lies with a minimal tautness on its frame. It responds sympathetically to the bones. I come across this body in the mirror and note the muscles work the moving parts as slowly they pull the arms above the head. Within my trunk, what labor is in progress? I hear not only the thudding of the heart, but the smallest veins tunneling through the skin. My lungs inflate as faithfully as my heart. My stomach lumbers on with its juicy task. My kidneys keep each other company. I have heard the surge of my blood at the worst times. Standing in front of a class as the professor, I've lost the thread of some wiry argument, just to follow the tide that retreated from my temples. While typing a poem only the other day, my mind of a sudden stooped to take my pulse. Imaginary fingers that felt my feet followed the mystery of the moving blood under the calves and thighs and the buttocks and back, into and out of the organs in search of the cells. 34 years of age and all was well, said sighs of relief made possible by my lungs. The lion lives at the circus as well as the zoo. At the circus he's not himself, and far away I can see him concentrating upon the whip that threatens to break and slap him across the back. He doesn't even know that I'm there. At the zoo, don't tell me it isn't another matter. The lion never misleads me with feigned indifference. Though we lie on the floor of his cage, zoo after zoo, so still that he scarcely seems to be alive, I know that behind his teeth, he's waiting for me. The dark room behind his eyes has developed me. He sees my body smaller beneath its suits. He knows that his claws can cut me out of the cloth. He has practiced killing me 1,000 times. There on the floor of the cage, he paws my head. There on my broken limbs, he licks the blood. Stripping them of the skin, he has caught my ribs and worried my heart with a snarl of his shaking head. It's strange the beast considers me its food, but there he is, and he has no doubt about it.
Magnificent.
The next poem I will read was written after I had read an interview with the American poet Carl Shapiro. And in this interview, Shapiro was asked what advice he would give to a young poet. And Shapiro said, "If a young poet should ask me what to do, I would tell him, praise something, anything." This poem is called Urine, a Poem of Praise. For the yellow urine so loves the toilet bowl, it splashes the bank to spray across the lake, mixing the water splendidly with color. Then tuned upon the center, it churns to froth, contentious, eccentric circles are lost in froth, and foam, yellow foam, spills out to the water's edge. Oh, quick, flush these beautiful bubbles down, down. Let the small maelstrom carry them out of sight, whirling and sucking them under in their delight, before this surface can settle weak and pale and flap, flap like leftover ginger ale. Before the reading, somebody asked me to read this nice poem. This is for you. This is an early love poem, and love poems should all have romantic titles, and this one, of course, does. It's called Blackheads. It's a very serious poem.
Great.
I know. Now in the after play, I press my fingers against these blemishes on your warm and beautiful back. These little worm-like fatty masses in your follicles where I've just held your flesh in the grip of passion. What are they made of? They leap forth, the black tips followed by the sinuous tails like miniature strings of toothpaste, but a sickly white. Can dirt be so white? Are they made of soap? Who would dare analyze them for taste? Though I have run my tongue lovingly over your body, I would lack such courage. Some are so deep, they take seconds to empty, if indeed they do empty. Has no one squeezed them before me? Were they there all the time, gathering, deepening, waiting for the touch of my fingers? Keep secret imperfections kept virginal for a lover. Well, those are a few of the earlier poems. I'll move on to the next section of the poem of the book, which is called Later Poems. And first poem I'll read is called The Unfinished Poem. And I'll follow that by a poem called The Cow. These poems were written when I was first settling into life in Ireland, after I'd moved to Killiscublinan in County Clare, having decided against the Canary Islands. So anyway, here it is, the unfinished poem. I look up from my desk to a small window, and the unfinished poem shrinks to a piece of paper. A closed sky hangs on over Killiscublinan. Those clouds in the one corner might bring rain. And there on the nearest rise, a cow scratches herself on my water tank. There's a white cow standing upon the hill, surely the whitest cow I shall ever see. As usual with cows, she's eating grass. Nothing strange about that, except that the light, the white light of the sun, increases her white until she seems like a moon reflecting the sun, a cow-shaped moon newly materialized to dazzle upon the rise of a grassy hill. Perhaps she is the cow that jumped over the moon, but how much grass can she nonchalantly bite with that white light breaking upon her body? Oh, now she raises her head, and striking a pose, commands the field with a curve of her delicate tail. And so I see that she's become a goddess, exacting and appreciating the homage owed to a white spirit by darker creatures. Those dull cows browsing in brown below her, mere cows, I see that they cannot comprehend how their appearance enhances the white goddess. And yet, their heads are lowered in due respect. She is their deity and she is mine, although I see her only from my distance. I see her only through my grimy window. Suppose I left my papers and left my desk, walked through the garden, crossed the old stone wall, slogged through the swamp at the bottom of the hill. Then with lowered eyes I could approach that whiteness. Would I be touched to some extent by the sunlight, and would my eyes be blinded with revelation? Or would I find cow dung beneath my feet? And would she and I eat grass for the rest of my lives? Thank you very much. another poem written shortly after I was settling in Hills for the nap. October morning, two of my neighbors who sadly are no longer with us are mentioned by name in this poem, Mickey Vaughan and Jimmy Murray. 7 o'clock, and the early October sun is yet to appear on the Ennis Simon Rise. Darkness illuminates the grass and stones, but a kitchen light comes vaguely over the fields. In the calm, I hear the patient sound of cattle as the morning advances on Kilspulenan. Another day in Kilspulenan. From my study now in the sky-reflected sun, I can see the outlines of our neighbor's cattle. They are scattered against the gray of the western hill. Shadows disintegrate along the fields, and here and there, the light discovers stones. As the light brightens, walls made of gray and white stones crisscross the small divisions of Kilspulenan. The corn has been harvested in all the fields, and the grass is a wet green in the risen sun. Our water tank stands squat on the brow of the hill, where Mickey Vaughan is striding for his cattle. His dogs run round him, barking in the cattle, moving down to the passage through the stones that turns into the cowhouse underneath the hill. It's milking time in Kilspulenan. After a while, his cap set against the sun, he will carry our can of milk across his fields. His neighbors will accompany him across the fields, disturbed at the falling market price for cattle, pleased at the unseasonable persistence of the sun. Then together we'll view the latest pile of stones dug from the various corners of Kilspulenan by another neighbor who lives on another hill. In time, Jimmy Murray, who hauled those stones over the hill to rebuild the walls where our acre adjoins Mickey's field, will leave his house at the edge of Kilspulenan. He will pass along the road with his dogs and cattle, then return to help me lift and place the stones. Perhaps we will finish the walls while we have the sun. Any day now, the sun will disappear from the hill, and rain will drop like stones on all our fields, and the cattle will plod through the mud in Kilspulenan. The tour of the garden. The garden is larger than it's ever been. We have carrots, parsnips, and peas, as well as potatoes. We have green beans, broad beans, and cabbage, as well as onions. We have plenty of beetroot, even though no one eats it. Hurrah! 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 Hurrah for the garden. Up front, near the two ridges of iceberg lettuce, you can see where we broke the plow into the sewer. That old door is to keep you from falling in. One more garden poem. My peas, my cabbage. Nature, look kindly on my peas. Strengthen their stalks where the advancing season sees the slugs walk. This summer, let no hungry crow or caterpillar discover where my cabbage grows. Indifferent killer. I was born in St. Louis. St. Louis, not St. Louis. As you've heard. And I grew up in nearby Webster Groves, Missouri, which may explain the title of the next poem, in Webster Groves, Missouri. In a backyard in Webster Groves, Missouri, a young man could consider his lot confining. He would see more of himself than shirts and socks and something less familiar than the tired path to the fish pond. Well, that's the way it is with a young man. And a young man is right to get away, as far away as Athens if he gets a chance, and not stay put there either, if he can avoid it. He will come to regret his decision. It may be. which is not to say he was any better off in Webster Groves, Missouri. Two sentences. My father died with small change in his pocket. He was never president of my mother's fan club. I wrote the next poem after reading a book. It's one of the most literary influences, I guess, of any of my poems. I read The Slow Approach of Thunder by Konstantin Pastowski. And in this book, he describes a moment when he's traveling across the vast sweeps of Russia, and he looks out a train window, and he sees a man standing in the doorway of a small house. And he's written the book years later, but he says, I still see the old man with the sheepskin coat thrown over his shoulders who came out of the low door. And this is my sort of variation on that. The old man. There he is, the old man, coat over his shoulders. Do you not still see him? Imagine a low door as I do. There he is. Time out of mind he stands, the sheepskin coat ready, ready by the low door to pass into your mind. His business, the low door, your past in his presence. He composes your life. I think maybe one more poem from this section of the book. A poem called Water and Rock. This poem was actually commissioned. Twice I've been asked to write a poem on a particular subject. And in this case, I was commissioned by a photographer to write a poem about a photograph she had taken. The photograph shows a stream of water passing over some rocks, rapidly going downstream. And so here it is, Water and Rock, three voices from a photograph by Becky Bolenruby. One, my moment of passage. My moment of passage allows these options to take the broad path past all obstruction, to set my course with measured care through the narrow channels, or to strike full force and burst to spray, but not without adding my signal weight to the world's recreation. Two, luck set me down. Luck set me down here in this stream, my spray-drenched features shining. No problem, these dents and crannies. They evidence weakness washed off. How different from being a chronic slab, a bed for another bed to lie on. Three, water, rock, spray. Day after day, say what you please, all slips away and all stays at ease. Water, rock, spray. I'm each of these. Some years ago, I suddenly took a departure from the kind of poems I was writing, and for some time, I wrote a series of narrative poems. These are all brief narrative poems, and they never tell a complete story, but just give you a piece of the story. The speakers in the poems are all fictitious characters, as well as the people described. I'll read a few of these. Thank you. broken cup. He bent over me, took my cup and dashed it onto the tiles. No, that isn't right. He bent over me, took my cup and dropped it. Well, no. He bent over me and, taking my cup, he let it slip through his fingers to the tile floor. Whatever, it smashed into a million pieces, three sizable bits and a scatter of splintery shards. You clumsy asshole, I said, in frozen shock. Not that. Watch what you're doing, I said, and he looked at the floor. No, not that. Oh, I'm sorry, I said, and be careful, I said, and don't cut yourself. Sometimes the speakers of these poems are women, that one possibly was, and sometimes they're men, and sometimes they're not sure. The male speaker in this next one, a poem called What Trudy Knows. I find myself mourning, but not for anyone we've buried, and not for the old neighborhood or my lost youth or any of that crap. To make no bones about it, I'm mourning myself. Trudy doesn't get it at all. When she lays her head on my chest and her yellow hair lies loose all over my stomach, I still turn over her way and I do my homework. But she knows it isn't the same. Even as I enter her body, she knows I'm going through the motions. It's easier at work. I can laugh at my buddy's jokes and tell a few of my own when we break for coffee, and no one's the wiser. The boss is always can see I clock in on time. But I know, and Trudy knows, that the man who took up space in this world under my name has slipped out the door without so much as a by your leave. How she sticks it, I don't know. But we have our meals as usual, and we visit her folks as usual, and we go to the movies or go bowling, and we fight about money we don't have for the new baby, and it's only the odd time I catch her looking at me when she doesn't see I see her. And I know she knows. Dinner with Monica. Back to a female speaker. Bob piled our plates on the tray and carried them off to the kitchen. It was then we heard the prolonged and unmistakable sputter of a pent-up fart. It gave us an awkward moment during which Monica studied her placemat, and then she asked brightly if Bob did much of the cooking. Oh yes, I replied. Bob cooks on weekends and sometimes on special occasions. It's your luck that you happened by on one of his nights. My luck indeed, said Monica. That artichoke salad was splendid. Bob came in then with the main course, Cornish hens mandarin and steamed bok choy. We ate our fill as Monica enlarged on her plans for the new boutique she was opening in March. The wine Bob had chosen was a brisk Chardonnay, which seemed just the perfect companion to Monica's excitement. We have only some leftover pear crisps for dessert, Bob said as he rose again to clear the dishes. Shall I bring it in with the coffee? Then he was off to the kitchen once more, where we could hear him running the water tap and scraping the plates into the garbage pail and opening the pantry door to fetch the pear crisps. Monica's placemat, incidentally, offered a view of the Grand Canal. It was one of a set my sister Claire brought back from Venice. I'll read one more of these, the other shoe, and I'll leave it to you to figure out the gender of this speaker. I think you will. The other shoe. My other shoe has got to be somewhere, she said. Or does this bed of yours keep them up? I watched her head disappear, leaving a view of her man's red shirt, unbuttoned but covering her back. And over her bottom was its reinstated white cotton panties. Success at last, came her muffled voice, and she scuttled backward on her knees. Christ, but it's dirty in there, she said, dropping her sneaker and picking at a dust ball. You should hire me to clean your place, Professor. It's another one of my talents. Don't professor me here, I said, reaching out, but she was up on her feet too quick and stepping into her jeans. Her hair was wildly array, but it hardly mattered. It suited her red face and its lack of makeup. They don't make them as old as they used to. I was glad I wouldn't have to give her a lift back to her dorm. She had said she preferred to walk. But I did wonder what we would say to each other, what arrangements we might make. At the door, she gave me a kiss so brief that we scarcely touched. I like your perfume, Professor, she said. You might give me a bottle sometime. And with that, she was gone. I did not have to drive her back, but I would have to read her essay on Georgia O'Keeffe, making the usual allowances, of course, and perhaps a few more. Thank you. Now I'll read a couple of poems that aren't in the book. Here's one called A Decent Skin. Oh, him, she laughed. He's a decent skin, I suppose. She spoke as we left the party, referring to one of the men who had clustered around her. I didn't think much about it as I drove her back to her house and followed her into her kitchen and then into her bed, as I did those days. But now I do. I think of his decent skin as he moves his hands, and then as his groin stretches, and then as he eases his stomach on top of hers. The dog in the street. The dog lies in the middle of the road, indifferent as an occasional car maneuvers around it. Only once, when a driver honks, does it lift its head from its paws before settling again on the gravel. Is this what they have in mind when they call it a dog's life? Whatever those words mean, it's a life I'm living, I suppose, stuck as I am by this window, looking out this window at a dog, and a dog I don't know, and asking which one of us will be the first one of us to get out of the way. See how I'm doing on time here. Okay. I'll move on to the last section of the book, which is called Reason and New Poems. And this first poem, excuse me, it's page 238. This first poem is written about the muse, the figure. Try to describe these things, the figure told me. Seedlings turned toward sunlight, butterflies coming in swarms. Sooner or later, soon, you will lapse into silence. Those who tried before, she had my attention, failed to produce a light of raindrops poised on bark, of leaves dropped on soil, and have lapsed into silence. Before you account for me, I spoke to her back. I will have been those leaves, petioles, stipules, blades, each compact part, and will be silent. Fun with earthworms and crabgrass. I sat down inside. Earthworms sighed with me, a great pervasion of air. I stood up and stretched. Laboring crabgrass lengthened. We were all having fun. I lay down and died, and the disengaged specks of me merged in a great permeation. I ran, cursing and stumbling, from the wreck. But as I did so, the scene dissolved and there in a metal set God. "You're welcome," God said as I dropped into perfect grass, suffused with music and light. Then, sheltered by wings, my body curled and slept at God's feet. They couldn't attend to me at first, having quite enough to do extracting bones and flesh from the torn metal. But after some time, their sirens still sounding in the garish blaze of their spinning lights, they lifted from the pavement me, whom they placed with care on a stretcher, as though I were there. This next poem is about reincarnation. It's called Stretches. I approached the end of the way, which leads, as the other ways did, to a difficult gate. And beyond that, a short stretch of cluttered sand. And beyond that, an endless stretch of receding sea. The sign on the gate reminds me of the signs I have left behind. I study the signs. Then I look on the stretching sand, and beyond that the endless stretch of receding sea. Then I push open the gate. A few years ago, a good friend of mine, Kate Thompson, came by the cottage where we were living and told me that she thought I was making a great mistake. At that time, I was writing a series of fictional poems. She said that that wasn't my true gift, that what I should be doing is writing lyrical poems. And she brought with her a stanza. She said, "Now just use this as a starting point and see what you can do." And she brought me this stanza called, well, it doesn't have a title. "Last night the earth lay naked in the emptiness of space, and the cold kiss of the planets has left frost upon her face." I didn't think that was a great stanza, but I thought that it was a challenge, and that I shouldn't just automatically turn it down. So I wrote a series of poems, and what I did in each of these poems, I used the stanza form that she gave me, and I used words from that stanza. In each of these poems, some of those words will appear. And I call it thematic variations. And I'll read you just a couple of these poems. It's 258. So this is for you, Kate. Some of you may know Kate Thompson's work. She's the author of several prize-winning books for children. This one's called "At Night Her Love Lay Fervent." "At night her love lay fervid in the throes of her embrace, but his cold kiss by daylight was frost upon her face. She clothed herself in garments designed to captivate, took pains to please his palate when she prepared his plate. But he responded mildly to oaths of love she swore, until the planets brought them between the sheets once more, and then he urged his ardor with compliments galore. Season followed season, she found him much the same. She gave him sons and daughters, and they assumed his name. His shoulders sagged, he shuffled, gray hair streaked his head. He felt the earth grow empty climbing into bed. She marveled at the passion in words she heard him rave, while doctors labored over the life they could not save. And then her other lovers bore him to his grave." One more. all this. This was called Maya, and I'm using Maya in the Hindu term for illusion. Last night the earth lay naked and whistled stop in space, and the cold kiss of the ether spread frost upon its face, and the whitefish and the whippet in the bleak imposing paws saw the frozen diatonic in their frozen scales and paws. And the sleeper in the bedroom with his face toward the wall saw there wasn't any reason to expect a morning call, saw that nothing was the matter of matter after all. But when sunshine punched its time card and illumined north and south, then the dog brought in the paper with headlines in its mouth. And the sleeper, now awakened to a frisky whirligig, saw the players through the window with their raiments and their rig, saw the boxer and the beauty choose their places in the scene, saw the gymnast diathrosis perform upon the green, and once more there were voices on the answering machine. Well, I think it's getting fairly near the end. What's that? That's Sergeant Pepper. And it's, okay, anyway, here's just a couple more. Edna Fay. Paul, I think you've introduced me to Edna in the corner of the room here. Edna Fay is a pub where the dark red wood glistens behind the bar, where the pints are pulled slowly and are never too cold, where the salmon and chicken arrive with three different kinds of potatoes. And I'll conclude with a poem called On the Infinite, 231. This is another commission poem. The second of two. And I was one of a large number of Irish poets who were asked to write a poem in response to a poem by Giacomo Leopardi, the 19th century Italian poet whose 200th anniversary was being celebrated. And an anthology was published of these poems responding to Leopardi's work. I was given 10 poems of Leopardi's in English translation and asked to choose one and to write a response directly to it. I chose a poem of Leopardi's called The Infinite. And in this poem, Leopardi is looking out on a field that is particularly important to him, on a hill. And he's imagining, I'll read just 2.5 lines from Leopardi's poem. But as I sit and look, within my thoughts I conjure up unending space, the other side of it. On the infinite. Your lonely hill was dear to you, as was the hedge which masked your view of the horizon. I read your words here in my home in Clare, and look out on a hill that is dear to me, a gradual rise of meadows rich with grass, divided partly up by an old stone wall, half fallen here and there, beset with briars, a solitary boulder left behind when the field was cleared for grazing, interrupts whitely the green that rises toward the sky. And at the top, green shrubs show in their shapes the tireless action of the Atlantic wind. And as I sit viewing this scene, I know that I occupy the other side of your hill and the other side of time, such as it is. Thank you. Thank you very much. You've been a wonderful group of people to read to. I enjoyed this very much. Thank you.